From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What are you doing Thanksgiving? On today's Fresh Air, we'll find out what Garrison Keillor has planned. More important, we'll find out what kind of man he is. Is he a lover, artist, and adventurer? Does he engage in recreational weeping? Can he defend himself with his bare hands? Has he had a midlife crisis? All these questions relate to his new book of short stories, The Book of Guys. And what kind of woman is Robin Williams? Stephen Schiff reviews the new film, Mrs. Doubtfire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate set aside their differences and passed the Brady Bill today. The measure to require a 5-day waiting period for the purchase of a handgun is on its way to the president. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
This is Fred.
The Brady Bill's cycle of death and rebirth is over. In the closing hours of the session, Senate Democrats and Republicans agreed to pass the Brady Bill now and vote on certain technical details related to the bill in January. Majority Leader Democrat George Mitchell of Maine said the bill is a significant step, but tried to lower expectations of what it will do.
It will not by itself end gun violence in America. No one should denigrate this measure by establishing for it an impossible standard which it must necessarily fail to meet.
Senator Mitchell said he expects the president to sign the Brady Bill shortly. This is John Greenberg on Capitol Hill.
The Israeli army says that it has killed the leader of the military wing of the Muslim extremist group Hamas. An army statement said that soldiers shot Imad Akal as he allegedly ran from a car at a roadblock in Gaza City. The army says Akal shot at police and was killed by return fire. It said that Akal, who was 24, was the head of the Hamas military wing. Akal had claimed responsibility for the killing of two Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip last month. Hamas opposes the Israeli PLO agreement on Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and the West Bank town of Jericho. Foreign relief workers were evacuated from the central Angolan town of Quito today amid renewed fighting between rebel and government forces. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Western diplomats said that relief workers from Britain and France had been withdrawn from the devastated Angolan town of Quito. The move comes after a fresh round of fighting between government troops and UNITA rebel forces. An estimated 30,000 people have been killed or have died of starvation in Quito since Angola's long civil war resumed last January. Foreign relief workers had recently flown to the city to care for survivors after a tenuous ceasefire was declared. Diplomats said that recent fighting began earlier this week when government planes mistakenly dropped food by parachute on UNITA positions. Since then, attempts by government troops to recover the supplies have met with fierce resistance. Fresh fighting was also reported in other parts of Angola. Meanwhile, peace talks continued in Lusaka, Zambia, with both the government and UNITA reportedly far from reaching an agreement. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street after reports of growth in factory orders for durable goods and an unexpected drop in unemployment claims. The Dow Industrials gained 13 points to close at 3,687.6. This is NPR News. In Britain, two 11-year-old boys have been found guilty of kidnapping and murdering a 2-year-old boy. The two boys were sentenced to indefinite detention. The case drew wide attention because of the age of the boys and their victim, who was abducted from a Liverpool shopping mall while his mother's back was turned. The two older boys worked part-time for a video rental shop, and the judge said he suspected that exposure to violent films may have contributed to their decision to commit the crime. A temporary bridge serving as an off-ramp for Interstate 89 in southern New Hampshire collapsed this morning, crushing two construction workers and injuring another. For member station WEVO, Eric Niclamo reports.
Four workers were dismantling the 200-foot-long temporary bridge when the structure gave way. State Trooper Michael Nolan was at the scene.
This bridge, as we're standing on at this point, had been completed, and they were in the process of taking down the Bailey Bridge, at which time, upon removing one of the last bolts, the bridge collapsed on them, killing two.
A third worker sustained head injuries and was taken to a local hospital and is in stable condition. No cars were under the bridge when it fell. The temporary structure known as the Bailey Bridge is commonly used in highway construction projects. State transportation officials say the accident will not delay heavy holiday traffic. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Niclimo in Concord, New Hampshire.
Philip Morris Company said today that it will cut 14,000 jobs and shut down or reduce operations at 40 of its plants over the next 3 years. The job cuts would amount to 8% of the giant tobacco and food company's workforce. A Philip Morris spokesman said the company hasn't determined yet how many of the job cuts will require layoffs. Analysts said that the company's earnings were hit hard by a cigarette price war earlier this year with makers of discount cigarettes. In addition to its tobacco company, Philip Morris owns Kraft General Foods. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wouldn't it be swell to have Garrison Keillor over for Thanksgiving dinner? Well, he's already got plans, but he's visiting us today on our day before Thanksgiving program. Garrison Keillor is, of course, the host of the ever-popular A Prairie Home Companion. He has a new collection of short stories called The Book of Guys. It's a series of satires about what it means to be a man. Let's get started with a reading from the opening story. This is the story of a man who, in a poker game, has won a membership in a club called the Sons of Bernie. The annual Bernie Campfire is a drunken orgy of song and self-pity where men gather around a bonfire to sing manly songs like Streets of Laredo and complain about women. This leads him to reflect on the state of manhood.
It's hard to put your finger on, but guys are in trouble. Guys are gloomy. We try to cheer ourselves up. We go down to the Lost Hombre Saloon and hoist a margarita with some sad guys from the sanitation department. And we tell them, hey, tomorrow's a new day. So we put on our pants in the morning and think, hum, babe, come on, hum, babe, attaboy, let's go, babe. Play from within yourself, babe. Good as you want to be, babe, let's go, babe. Hum, babe, hum it in there, babe. Focus, babe. Center yourself, babe. Come on, babe, hum, babe, hum, babe. Feel good about yourself, babe. Or we say the prayer of St. Jeff. Breathe deeply. Relax, let go of all stress and anger, and be here within yourself in the universe where you are truly welcome, really. Or we go to a steam room and cook. Or we go to a ball game. Or we go to a Unitarian monastery in New Hampshire. The rule there is complete silence, but if you think of something really good, you can go ahead and say it. Years ago, manhood was an opportunity for achievement, and now it's a problem to be overcome. Plato, St. Francis, Michelangelo, Mozart, Leonardo da Vinci, Vince Lombardi, Van Gogh, you don't find guys of that caliber today. And if there are any, they're not painting the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel or composing Don Giovanni. They're trying to be Mr. OK All Right, the man who can bake a cherry pie, go play basketball, come home, make melon balls, whip up a great souffle, converse easily about intimate matters, participate in recreational weeping, laugh, hug, be vulnerable, be passionate in a skillful way, and the next day go off and lift them bales into that barge and tote it, a guy who women consider acceptable. Being all right is a dismal way to spend your life, and guys are not equipped for it anyway. We're lovers and artists and adventurers, meant to be noble, free-ranging, and foolish, like dogs, not competing for a stamp of approval, friend of womanhood. Now women watch us and monitor our conversation for signs of bad attitude. They grade us daily, and boys, we're in the wrong class. Men can never be feminists. Millions have tried, and nobody did better than C+.
This is a very funny book, Garrison. What are some of the things that got you on this guy jag? I mean, so many of the stories are kind of satires of the new sense of what men should be.
It's not called a guy jag. a jag is a crying jag.
Okay.
It's a trail. It's, uh-huh. It's a long trail that winds up into the foothills of guyhood.
Some of your stories are, I think, kind of spoofing parts of the men's movement, and I'm wondering what, if any, dealings you've had with the movement.
I've never had any dealings with it, and I believe that the men's movement is a work of fiction, so far as I can see. I think that somebody told you about it, and so you assume it exists. I think it's like El Dorado. It's like any other fictional place. It's like Yoknapatawpha County. It's all made up. And I have yet to meet anybody who knows anybody who has ever heard of anybody else who's related to anybody who's ever gone off and hugged trees and painted their chest with tribal markings and passed the talking stick around and talked about the need to find the warrior within.
But something about it struck you enough to do your humor related to it, too.
Hey, now, these are stories about guys. These are guys, and these are guys who are on their own. They are pursuing their lonely visions. I have a boy who catches leprosy in Africa on his way to see the witch dentist. He's a missionary child, and he has to deal with this alone. He does not go into a group. Dionysus, the god of wine, when he turns 50, does not find a group of other aging gods who he can get together with and talk about these things. Groups are notably missing from this book. These are guys, and guys pursue a lonely path in life. But as one of them says, loneliness ain't bad compared to desperation.
So what kind of guy were you when you were growing up?
I was a strange little guy. I was an invisible guy. I was a middle child. And middle children are more or less overlooked by everyone. I developed a facility when I was a child for being invisible. And this is the most valuable thing a writer can have, to be able to be with other people. And they talk, and you sit there, and you don't say anything. You listen to everything, and your silence does not make them uneasy.
You know, the kind of invisibility you're talking about, it's great in retrospect as an artist to look back on it and think, gosh, I was so lucky I got to observe without being noticed myself. But when you're young and invisible, it doesn't feel so good, I think.
I don't know. I felt very secure. I grew up amongst people who had a very clear vision of this life and the life to come. And so that was a very secure place for a shy little boy who was extremely thin and nearsighted and who never, ever got good haircuts. And who sort of feasted off the pages of the National Geographic and dreamt about the faraway world. I don't think it was so bad. I don't think it was so bad at all. Childhood trauma, I really am lacking. I'll never get on daytime television.
In your first story, the character says girls had it better from the beginning. Don't kid yourself. They were allowed to play in the house where the books were and the adults, and boys were sent outdoors like livestock. Did you like to be at home reading? Did you prefer?
I did, and when my parents, as punishment, sent me up to my room, that was the best punishment I could ever get. If they wanted to punish me, they should have sent me outdoors. I remember roaming around outdoors in fields and ravines, shooting cap pistols and playing wars that didn't really interest me very much, but it seemed to be all that was going on. No, girls were much smarter. They found out about relationships between people, about social relationships and family relationships much easier than boys did. Boys were really disadvantaged by their upbringing, I think.
This character makes a list.
I'm trying to make a case for us as victims. You see,
victims, right?
I know it's far fetched, but you have to grant me the opportunity.
In this character's list of useful things that he can do and useful things he can't do, in the can't do category, he can't defend himself with his bare hands. Did people ever pick fights with you or pick on you? And how did you hold your own?
I didn't hold my own. I was afraid, and so I had to learn how to insult people in a way that would make the bystanders laugh at them.
Uh-huh.
That was the best way of dealing with a bully. There were two twins, two hatchet-faced twins who went to the school that I went to, and they were lean and wiry, and they loved to just pound the cookies out of people. And I remember insulting them both. I think I said they had me cornered, and I said, I don't know which one of you is uglier. Sometimes I think you are, and sometimes, I mean, it wasn't brilliant, but it made other people laugh, and this confused them, and this withered them somehow. It withered their vitals, and they said something, oh yeah, like that, and turned and walked away.
Garrison Keillor is my guest. He has a new collection of short stories called The Book of Guys. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Garrison Keillor, who has a new collection of short stories called The Book of Guys. Well, one of the very funny stories in your new book is called The Midlife Crisis of Dionysus. Dionysus is the god of wine, and the story takes place right after Dionysus has turned 50. You want to explain his midlife crisis?
He is the god of wine and of revels and of orgies. The orgies were a part of pagan religion. They were not Puritans. They believed that you did not get more unless you showed that you were enjoying what you already had. So he's sitting in his temple on Mount Cithaeron with a nubile maiden, and the muse of maturity comes clomping in, and she says, "You are 50 years old, bud." He says, "That's impossible. I'm a god. I'm immortal. You can look it up." She says, "Ha," she says, "everybody gets to be immortal just so long, and then they have to grow up. Everybody's young for thousands of years, and then they have to face the music. You are 50. That's his crisis. Another man becomes the god of wine, and Dionysus becomes the chairman of wine, and works on task forces to maximize wine growth and expand the total wine experience. And he realizes that joyful and carefree part of his life is over, and that now he will be spending more and more of his time in the company of people with the emotional range of Lucite, people with personalities like 3/4-inch cardboard. He realizes this with sadness, of course, but still he has lived, he has memories, and he still has a possibility of perhaps the occasional revel, if not an all-out orgy.
Did writing this coincide with a midlife crisis of your own?
I came very close to having a midlife crisis. I came within about a week and a half of it. I was on the verge of turning 50 and dreading it. And then my mother told me, this really astounded me, she told me that I had been a precocious kid. Of course, I knew that. And that she had had to lie about my age in order to get me into school. She'd added 3 years to my age. So actually, I was 47 years old.
That's not a true story, is it?
It really surprised me. It didn't seem fair, somehow, to lose 3 years of childhood and, mm-hmm. and get 3 years of late middle age, but I'm making the best of it. And so my midlife crisis has been postponed. It's off waiting for me in the future. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to make the most of it.
This Dionysus story, you know, when he goes home really hungover from having gone to an orgy in spite of his middle age, Ariadne gives him the ultimatum, get help or get out.
Yes.
And then in the story you imagine what it would be like if he went into therapy because, you know, gods would have serious problems to confide to therapists. Now, I was reading this and I was thinking, God, this really reads like the book of somebody who was, like, reluctantly sent to therapy and felt really uncomfortable there. So you see the question coming.
What's that?
So,
was I ever reluctantly sent into therapy?
Yeah, or reluctantly go, or go
no.
enthusiastically and then feel, what am I doing here?
No. I think therapy is a, therapy is a great vast field and it includes, I'm sure, many colorful charlatans, but all sorts of friends of mine have done this and have had wonderful experiences. One of my old woman friends from back in college days, a fellow English major, is a psychotherapist and a psychiatrist. We have lunch regularly. She's my therapist. All I do is buy her lunch and I get a free hour and a half at very reduced prices. That's the best kind of therapy, really, is from skilled pals who have known you for 30 years.
So you haven't been in a more formal kind of therapy?
No, that's formal enough. Lunch, we have lunch in nice places. I mean, there's napkins and everything, but no, I don't. We don't lie down when we eat lunch. We just talk.
Are there things that you find embarrassing about people's midlife crises?
No, I don't. I think one of the advantages of growing up is that you become less and less embarrassed by yourself or by anyone else. And when I see people who are experiencing shame in public, my heart goes out to them. I feel I would like to put my hand on their shoulder and say, don't take this so hard, really. This goes away in not that long. This is not for the rest of your life.
Your book is all about guys. Did you ever read anything that helped you understand women?
I have been helped to understand women by women friends. And this book about guys is prompted in some part by my realization in the last few years that most of my closest friends over a long period of time have been women, and I need to get into a guy world. This has struck me in the last few years. I don't even know how to do it or what to do, but I find that my understanding of women sometimes gets in the way of my admiration of women, my infatuation with women, gets in the way of my being myself.
How so?
Oh, I adore the company of women, and I find it vastly interesting and amusing. Of course, I know wonderful women. Women who at least in my friendship with them are entirely missing the sort of rhetoric that people associate with something called the women's movement or with feminism. The women I know are all feminists, I'm sure. I'm down deep, they are. They all are strong and capable and even flamboyant. But they're very funny and perceptive people. They're really wickedly funny, funnier than me. And in their public life, they are much more careful than I am. They're very careful to present a sort of sober and almost maternal aspect to the world. But in private, they're gossipy and they're really wickedly satiric, and especially about other women.
Now, how does this get in the way, though? What do you feel you have to hold back from doing because of them?
I think that their experience is fascinating to me because it's so very different from my own. And so when I'm in the company of women, I'm in a foreign country. And I love to be in a foreign country. But in the end, one does have to come back to who you are. And I go and hang out with guys, not men in suits, not other writers necessarily, but hang out with guys. And I'm stunned by how much they are like me in ways that I am a little uncomfortable about.
Like.
I noticed this in Denmark somehow. Out in the west of Denmark, which is so much like the Midwest, going to small towns, practicing my Danish, meeting people, talking to Danish farmers in town on market day and standing around with them and talking about pigs and cows in Danish. And it dawned on me so much that these men, these Danish guys, in Danish a guy is a Führer, that they were me, that we were so much alike, but they never were English majors, they never did radio shows, they never wrote a book or ever thought of doing it, and yet we were just as alike as could be.
Now, what are those characteristics?
Inarticulate, yeah. And lonely,
mm-hmm.
And with a sort of bed of sadness on which we constructed wonderful jokes. They were very funny, and they told jokes that even I understood. Jokes you could say in English, even.
So do you find that sadness and loneliness is somehow something you're more likely to find in men than women?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not a statistician. I'm not a sociologist. I'm just a writer, and a writer travels a narrow path.
But it just sounded like these were the things you were finding in men that seemed to be lacking in relationships with women.
Oh no, I don't set myself up as an authority on women.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do that towards the end of my life. I'll go into business, but I need a few more years.
Garrison Keillor has a new collection of short stories called The Book of Guys. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Garrison Keillor will be back in the second half of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Did you hear the recent spoof of a Prairie Home Companion on The Simpsons? Garrison Keillor missed it, so coming up we're going to play it for him. It's part two of our interview with the host of A Prairie Home Companion. Also, an excerpt from our recent concert with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, the Austin-based singer-songwriter whose music has been called Zen Country. And what could director Chris Columbus do to follow Home Alone and Home Alone 2? How about a gender bender? Stephen Schiff reviews Columbus's new movie, Mrs. Doubtfire, starring Robin Williams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Congress has now approved the Brady Bill, calling for a 5-day waiting period and background checks for those wanting to buy handguns. The bill is named for one-time Reagan press aide James Brady, whose wife Sarah is among those who have campaigned for a number of years for gun control.
I thank my husband, who's for me has been an inspiration. And if I can take one more moment, then that's to thank our son, who was only 2 when Jim was hurt and has truly been victimized by this. And he's done without us pretty much for 7 years. And I hope for him and the rest of our kids, someday it'll be a little safer.
James Brady was severely wounded in an attack on President Reagan in 1981. In South Africa, the African National Congress has welcomed the lifting of U.S. economic sanctions against the nation. Yesterday, President Clinton signed a law erasing all remaining sanctions, one of the key international weapons used in the anti-apartheid campaign against South Africa. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The U.S. legislation comes just 2 months after ANC leader Nelson Mandela urged United Nations members to drop their sanctions programs. In a statement today, the ANC repeated earlier appeals for international investment to help redress the economic inequalities created under apartheid. The ANC said investors should target their assistance at black entrepreneurs whose business dreams were thwarted by apartheid restrictions. A trade delegation led by U.S. Commerce Secretary Ron Brown is due here this weekend to research investment possibilities, but many of the business people in Brown's delegation may be put off by South Africa's troubled economy and its high rate of political violence. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
In New York City, a construction accident has left 1 worker dead and 7 others injured. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports.
The accident occurred in Queens, where a project is underway to build New York City's 3rd water tunnel. Authorities say a 16-ton winch that was carrying steel beams became imbalanced, toppling into a 450-foot deep shaft where the workers were poised on a catwalk. Co-workers and rescue teams used a construction bucket to pull 7 people to safety, but 1 worker was apparently struck by the winch and killed. 4 workers required hospitalization for minor injuries, while the other 3 survivors were treated at the scene. When it's completed, the $5 billion tunnel will carry water from an upstate reservoir to points around the city. The 3rd tunnel will allow the city to shut down and repair its other 2 tunnels without a disruption to the city's water supply. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 13 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Snow hit parts of Colorado and Minnesota, causing problems for holiday traffic. At mid-morning, it was 4 above in Denver, and bad weather caused air traffic delays of up to 1.5 hours there. Airport personnel said that some flights were canceled and that larger planes were being used to consolidate flights. Weather officials say the storm is moving slowly to the north and the east. A former Vietnam War protester, Catherine Ann Power, a fugitive for 23 years, has been sentenced in federal court in Boston for her part in the 1970 holdup of a National Guard armory. This action followed her sentencing last month in a state court in Massachusetts. Doug McPherson of member station WBUR reports.
Power was ordered to pay a $10,000 fine and serve 5 years in prison, to be served concurrently with an 8 to 12-year sentence for her part in a 1970 bank robbery that resulted in the murder of a Boston police officer. The sentencing means Power will still be eligible for parole in 5 years. That plea agreement followed extensive negotiations between prosecutors and Power's lawyers, conducted while the former student radical was still in hiding. Her attorney, Ricky Kleeman, called today's sentencing a victory for the plea agreement process.
What it shows is that people can negotiate in good faith for a long period of time, enter a joint recommendation, and that recommendation is adopted, and that makes us all feel good about the system.
Power said she will live the rest of her life as an act of contrition for her crimes. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug McPherson in Boston.
The government says that new factory orders climbed by 2% last month. New factory orders in October were at their highest point ever and were led by transportation orders. Orders for new cars and airplanes climbed by 5.5% after falling more than 1% in September. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was mixed against other major foreign currencies. Gold prices moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're spending this day before Thanksgiving with Garrison Keillor, the host of A Prairie Home Companion. Isn't that the perfect public radio thing to do? Keillor has a new book of short stories called The Book of Guys. You have a lot of funny observations in the book about broadcasting, and there's even a whole story about a broadcaster. And actually, you come up with a great idea for a show. There's one story in which somebody has a show and he's competing with all these like tabloid-type talk shows. So one of the ideas for a show that you came up with is people who try to deal with their anonymity by writing a book about it and going on TV. I think that's like the ultimate premise for a talk show. But anyways, were you watching The Simpsons recently when Prairie Home Companion was spoofed?
I don't watch...
You don't watch TV?
Television. No, I gave it up so that I could write books.
Did you hear about it?
I have heard about it, but you see...
Do you want to hear the real thing?
Do you see, Miss Gross?
Yes, Mr. Keillor.
One of the interesting things about television is that people say, oh, they spoofed you on The Simpsons, uh-huh. But they never remember exactly what people say on television.
Yes, okay, so...
They never can quote it. And so I think you are the 10th person to tell me that it was on, but none of the others remembered what was said.
Well, let me be the first person to play you a tape of it.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. This is from The Simpsons.
Well, sir, it has been an uneventful week in Badger Falls, where the women are robust, the men are pink-cheeked, and the children are pink-cheeked and robust.
What the hell's so funny?
At the Apple Biscuit Cafe, where the smiles are free, don't you know? Sven Ingquist studied the menu, and finally he ordered the same thing he has every day.
Maybe it's the TV.
But TV, be more funny!
Well, sir, I think it is time to turn this pledge drive over to Troy McClure. I can't keep up this pace forever.
So what'd you think?
That's good. They got the timing right. The voice is a little more southern, I think, than mine. That's funny. That's good.
Yeah, I think it's really funny. I think that the person doing the voice is Harry Shearer, who is, yet another public radio personality.
Oh, I see.
I'm not sure, but it sounds like him to me.
Does it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly has the timing. That's partly the result of standing on stage and doing monologues and not having a script and trying to remember where this thing goes from here.
I thought you were going to say trying to fill time.
No, it's not trying to fill time. It is how people talk from my part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
We do. And that's what makes it so funny to ever try and carry on a conversation in New York at a social gathering. I have been to more things in New York City where I never got past the first subordinate clause. my commas sounded like the ends of paragraphs to people in New York. They're pretty fierce talkers.
Well, one of your characters in one of your stories has his own thing about public radio. He says, public radio, it's nothing but a cult, like Christian Science. It denies the reality of human nature. Public radio believes that if everyone only wore sensible shoes, there'd be no more suffering. comment.
It's true, of course. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It is. Public radio is a little colony which does forbid certain realities from entering in.
Like what?
Well, guy realities, for example. This is basically women's broadcasting public radio. I think deep down at heart, it has. Am I about to use the term female sensibility? Boy, I hope that's not me talking. No, but it keeps out vulgarity, and I like vulgarity. I think to eliminate vulgarity from humor is really to cut off your toe. I mean, you just it's kind of hopeless to do.
Yeah, but Garrison,
mature
you're not,
humor. There's no such thing as mature humor.
You're not thought of the person who has thrown open the doors to vulgarity.
I haven't. I think that I have.
Well, your last novel was criticized by some people for being too vulgar, but I've never heard that about your radio show.
Oh, yes, I think
really?
I think so. I think people are gassy much more regularly on my show and emit bodily gases and bodily orifices, nasal and others are dealt with, referred to more often than they are, say, on your show. Except when I'm on it, people are always sort of pulling things out of their nose on Prairie Home Companion because I have these kids who listen and they like that. And it's on radio that they can get that kind of vulgarity. You can't have comedy without it. People have to fall down. People have to belch. People have to have their bodies betray them.
Speaking of belching.
Yes.
What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I am making dinner. I'm missing a big family deal back in Minnesota. The Keelers are all getting together, thousands of them, and I am missing that, and I'm going to be making dinner in New York for family and various orphans. I'm very fond of Thanksgiving dinner, and the one I made last year, I think I could put up against any Thanksgiving dinner I ever had that was made by my mother or my aunts.
What'd you make?
Made the standard, straight, classic stuff. I did my turkey. I did my mashed potatoes. I caramelized them a little bit. I did my sweet potatoes, and I made my cranberry sauce. And everything was standard. I made my pies. That's the hard part, is the pie crust. That's the hardest part of Thanksgiving. The rest of it is pretty straightforward. If you can read, you can cook.
So what are your memories of Thanksgiving dinners? Was everything really convivial around the table, or was everybody bickering?
They were convivial in a sort of slow-talking Midwestern way. I remember guys who wouldn't talk very much and who were just real good eaters. I guess that I like a little more talk around a table than what I grew up with. Midwesterners do have modesty to a fault, and this modesty prevents them from being as entertaining as they have every right to be. They do pull back much too much. And so Thanksgiving in New York is fine by me because there's always two or three people I can invite who can carry the ball.
Well, what are the things you really love to keep about the holidays? And what are the things, now that, you know, you could do what you want to, that you're really glad to not do?
One thing that I'm glad I don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think women had the better part of the holidays, and I'm glad that I don't have to do as my father and my uncles had to do, and that was to sit in the living room and try and make conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hard part. The best conversation was in the kitchen, and people in the kitchen had real work to do, getting a complicated dinner ready for the table so it's all there at one time is not impossible, but it's complex and requires some help. And that's the most sociable place to be. It's the most wonderful place to be. Women of my generation seem glad to get out of the kitchen, and I'm glad for them to get out, and I'm glad to take their place. I would rather be there.
Do you overeat on the holidays?
Oh, slightly. But Thanksgiving is a big carbohydrate
carbohydrate festival.
Festival. It's not you know, you're not eating slabs of bacon. You're just eating tubers. To overeat on mashed potatoes and sweet potatoes is not the worst thing for you.
Well, I wish you very good holidays.
Thanks, you too.
And thanks for doing the interview.
You bet.
Garrison Keillor, his new book of short stories is called The Book of Guys. Well, if Garrison Keillor were hosting Fresh Air, he could use this opportunity to sing a song. Me, I get to play a recording of someone else singing. Coming up, an excerpt of our concert with Jimmy Dale Gilmore. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Dale Gilmore has the kind of lonely voice perfectly suited to his lonely country ballads. Last summer, after the release of his latest album, Spinning Around the Sun, he performed a Fresh Air concert. Here's a short excerpt. There's a song of yours I'd like to ask you to sing. I think this is perhaps your best-known song. And it's Tonight I Think I'm Going to Go Downtown. And it's a wonderful song. You wrote it, I think, when you were about 20. Can you put us in your frame of mind back when you were 20 and writing this song?
Well, I was, it was around the time of the breakup of my first marriage, you know, and it was when, I mean, I was still confused, is that the right word? Although that wouldn't contrast it to now too much. But I wrote this song, actually, I wrote the verse of it, probably when I was about 20, and it's one of these songs that took, it probably was a year and a half in the writing, and my friend John Reed wrote the music to the kind of bridge part of it, and then I finished the lyrics. It took a long time to write it, but I've always felt like this song, even to this day, really captured a feeling. It evokes a feeling I had that was like a combination of really sad but still hopeful. It's almost like a trademark of my whole, set of emotions or something about the songs I've written.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the song that in a way wears the best with me. Some of my other songs are, you know, I go to a bridge when I don't want to, when I'm tired of them or they don't seem, but this one I've always loved. I've never gotten tired of singing this song, and it's, I guess it's still most expresso part of me that's still really there. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, I sure am.
Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna look around for something I couldn't see when this world was more real to me. Yeah, tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. My love is gone away. My love, what can I say? My love would
could never see that this world's just not real to me. And tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. I told my love a thousand times that I can't say what's on my mind, but she would never see that this world's just not real to me. And tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna look around for something I couldn't see when this world was more real to me. Yeah, tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown. Tonight I think I'm gonna go downtown.
Jimmy Dale Gilmore from his recent Fresh Air concert. His latest album is called Spinning Around the Sun. This is Fresh Air. The Senate has passed the Brady Bill. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from reporter John Greenberg about what it was that permitted the Brady Bill to get through, what allayed the objections of Republicans in the Senate today. Also, we'll be hearing from John Burnett about the objections of some Native Americans to New Age religions that use Native American rituals. And some Native Americans object. And we'll also be hearing about a phenomenon called remigration, the turn of the century, late 19th, early 20th century, about how many European immigrants to America actually went back to Europe, on average about 30%.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If this is the start of the Christmas season, it's also the start of Chris Columbus season. Every year at about this time, the young director who got his start writing screenplays for Steven Spielberg comes up with a family hit. 2 years ago, it was Home Alone, which turned into the most successful comedy of all time. Last year, it was Home Alone 2. And this year, Columbus has teamed up with another Christmas perennial, Robin Williams, in Mrs. Doubtfire. Stephen Schiff has a review.
By now, you've seen the ubiquitous ads, so you know the premise. Robin Williams in drag as a stout British nanny. Yep, it's another cross-dressing movie. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Some Like It Hot and Tootsie, for instance, are two of the finest comedies of all time. And since Robin Williams is much funnier than Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and Dustin Hoffman combined, dressing him up as a kind of jumbo Mary Poppins ought to be good for a giggle or two, right? Well, let's just say three giggles would be stretching it. From the very start, this movie gives you such a hard sell that even the moments of patented Robin Williams lunacy go sour. The plot is simple. Williams plays Dan, an actor who does voices, mostly in cartoons. Sally Field plays his wife, Miranda, a successful interior designer, and the differences between them are sledgehammered into your skull. Dan is childlike and loving, but irresponsible, a hopeless mess. Miranda is prim, persnickety, and neat as a pin. Their three adorable kids love them both, but clearly this marriage is doomed. And when it breaks up, Dan receives only the skimpiest child visitation rights. So when Miranda advertises for a housekeeper and babysitter, Dan outfits himself as one Mrs. Doubtfire in order to spend more time with his kids. The job interview takes place mostly in Miranda's spotless kitchen, in the vicinity of her cupboards.
Oh, what a perfectly appointed little cubby. Look at this. Everything has its place and name tag. How precise. Lovely.
My husband never appreciated it.
Oh, poor dote. That's not the reason you divorced him, was it?
No.
So sad, because marriage can be such a blessing.
So can divorce.
Who?
Daniel is a very difficult man to live with. But the children are crazy about him.
Don't have to be a psychic to sense that.
My, you certainly do know your way around the kitchen.
Just because it's everything Mrs. so accessible. You designed it. I'm amazed there isn't a little label there that says spoons.
Poor Sally Field has been given the hopeless task of seeming at once warmly sympathetic, so will want Robin to get her back, and hard-hearted enough to refuse him reasonable time with his own kids. Robin Williams has been given the almost equally hopeless task of making the rather grim Mrs. Doubtfire seem lovable enough not only to win over the whole family, but also to get hired by a TV network as the next Mr. Rogers. Chris Columbus has the hopeless task of directing one tiresomely predictable scene after another, including not one but two big set pieces in which Williams has to run around frantically being Dan and Mrs. Doubtfire at the same time. But the toughest job anyone in this movie has is rescuing it from its own smug piety. The screenwriters want to be sure we understand all the serious subtexts, that fathers have rights too, that single parenthood is okay, and so forth. The messages are laudable, but they still make you want to kill the messenger. Robin Williams has been getting more earnest and goopy with every movie he makes. He, of all people, should know that comedy will smother to death if you coat it with sap.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia, Abby Fanta, and Deben Reif are our interns. I'm Terry Gross, and we wish you a great Thanksgiving. We're going to leave you with some gospel music sung by the great Marion Williams. I recorded an interview with her today that you'll hear in the near future on Fresh Air. Here's something from her new album, Can't Keep It to Myself.
Traveling shoes got on my traveling shoes. Traveling shoes got on my traveling shoes. Traveling shoes, child, got on my traveling shoes. Traveling shoes got on my traveling shoes. Dad came riding by my mother's door. He said, "Come on, mother, are you ready to go?" Mother's too dumb, begin to buckle up her shoe, child. She counted up her cause because she could not refuse. And she moved on down to the Jordan stream, and she shouted hallelujah. I've been redeemed, she said, yeah. Done done my duty, got on my traveling shoes. Traveling shoes, traveling shoes. Traveling shoes, traveling shoes, shoes. Got on my traveling shoes, traveling shoes, shoes. Got on my traveling shoes, traveling shoes, child. Got on my traveling shoes, traveling shoes, yeah. Got on my traveling shoes. Death came riding by the sinner door. He said, "Come on, sinner, are you ready to go?"
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We have an entertaining Fresh Air for Thanksgiving. We'll feature an interview with the wonderful singer Eileen Farrell. And we'll hear from actor John Leguizamo, the young gangster threatening Al Pacino in the film Carlito's Way. Also, David Bianculli reviews the new Bonanza TV movie. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.